This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, the big industry firm behind no taxes on tips. Last summer, at a campaign rally in Las Vegas, Donald Trump made a promise.
For those hotel workers and people that get tips, you're going to be very happy. Because when I get to office, we are going to not charge taxes on tips, people making tips.
And he stuck to that promise. No tax on tips made it into the tax and spending bill he signed into law earlier this summer. It was one of the few provisions in the package that drew some bipartisan support. The policy exempts up to $25,000 in tip income from federal income tax. Supporters say it's a big win for service workers. But if you look at the fine print, it appears that's not who stands to benefit the most.
Almost 40% of tipped workers don't actually make enough money to pay federal taxes.
That's Eyal Press. He's a contributing writer at The New Yorker and a fellow at Tite Media Center.
A casino dealer or maybe someone at a fine dining establishment, maybe they're making $70,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year or more, they're going to benefit. But the lowest paid workers won't benefit.
Eyal has reported on social inequality for years. And in his latest piece for The New Yorker, he reveals that one of the biggest forces behind the no tax on tips movement isn't a grassroots network of tipped workers like you might expect. It's the National Restaurant Association, which some labor advocates call the other NRA, a powerful industry lobbying group. And Eyal's reporting shows how the NRA has spent decades pushing a number of policies that claim to support service workers, but in reality, mostly benefit owners, managers, and big restaurant chains. We started by talking about a key aspect of the debate over how tipped workers are paid, the sub-minimum wage.
In more than a dozen states in the country, the base salary of a tipped worker is $2.13. There are states where the minimum wage is above $10 an hour. It's higher than the federal minimum wage. And yet, servers are still getting $2.13 an hour. That rate was set in 1996, and it has not changed in nearly 30 years. Now, technically, that's supposed to not matter if you ask the restaurant industry, because tips are supposed to compensate for that, and that is the law. But who keeps track of that? The government barely regulates it. And as I started talking to experts about this industry who have written about it, you know, one of the biggest problems in the restaurant industry is wage theft. Workers not getting the hourly pay that they were owed, not getting the pooled tips that were supposed to be distributed to them.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the moment that we're in and how we talk about tipping, because that does feel like it's part of it, right? I mean, you're talking about people who are making a tipped wage, people who are workers who get tipped, saying this is not working for them. This doesn't feel like they're making a fair living wage. It seems also, though, that the people doing the tipping really don't like it. There's a true grumpiness around tipping right now. How would you describe the cultural conversation around tipping? And what do you think that has to do with the policy conversation that's happening right now?
I think that's hugely important. And look, I'm one of the many, many people who at this point, I assume I have to tip everywhere. I mean, I go and buy, you know, a candy bar at a convenience store. Do I have to tip or do I just pay for the candy bar? We're all in that situation right now. And I think one of the takeaways I drew from my reporting, it was an insight shared by former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. He said, look, most customers think of tipping as a way to compensate the people serving them, right? That's who you see. You look at the person who's serving you and you think, okay, they really need this tip. And they do, by the way. But what you're really doing, the real function of tipping, he said, is subsidizing the employer. You think you're helping the worker, but you're actually helping the employer because they have to pay only that $2.13 or whatever that sub-minimum wage is. The rest falls on us.
So when it comes to restaurant workers who work for tips, just to be really clear, because I do think that people understand that there's a minimum wage. And if you haven't worked in a restaurant before, I worked in a restaurant when I was a teenager. I'm very aware that there is a sub-minimum wage. That's what showed up on my, you know, on my pay stub at the end. And I thought, wow, that's a low number. I guess I have to make up for it with tips. I mean, who is supposed to be keeping track of whether you are being made whole to the degree you're supposed to be being paid?
Basically, no one. And that's why wage theft and, you know, all kinds of exploitative practices do abound in the restaurant industry. And I should say, you know, this is an industry with a whole lot of really wonderful, idealistic restaurant owners who go into it because they love to cook or they love food or they want to share their culture. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on restaurant owners, but the fact of the matter is, there is very little regulation. And I cite one study in my piece. This really struck me. I happened to go to Colorado to do some of my reporting. In the Denver area alone, there were 45,000 workers in the year they looked at who had experienced wage theft. That is, who were supposed to get their wages, their pay stub, their minimum wage and plus, but didn't get it. And this cost cumulatively over $135 million in wages that these people did not get.
Oh, wow.
And who were among the most common people? Servers, hostesses, chefs. So that's a little clue right there. And that's just one city. There actually isn't a national study of wage theft that I know of. And I should say, in terms of who tracks this, one of the reasons I was skeptical of Donald Trump being a champion of tipped workers and the whole no tax on tips thing that he rolled out, which was a great way to get votes. Hey, there are a lot of tipped workers in Nevada, which is a swing state. There are a lot of tipped workers in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, and all these places. But during Trump's first term, the Department of Labor actually tried to slip through a regulation that would have allowed owners to pocket pooled tips for themselves. In other words, after the minimum wage is supposedly paid to everyone, the owners get to do what they want with those pooled tips, including them taking them for themselves. And one study estimated this would cost tipped workers $6 billion a year. There was such an outcry over that that Congress eventually blocked it from happening. But it was a little clue to me that, wait a minute, is Donald Trump really in this to help empower tipped workers? That doesn't suggest that he would be, his past policies. And furthermore, let's not forget, he's an owner, right? He owns resorts, golf clubs, hotels. So we do have to think about this in terms of owners and workers, and they are not the same.
Mm. Well, you point this out really clearly in your piece as you write about the lobbying arm behind no taxes on tips. That's the National Restaurant Association. Some labor advocates call it the other NRA, which I found very memorable. What is the National Restaurant Association? Can you tell me a little bit of its history?
Sure. It first rose to prominence in the 1990s. They helped lead the opposition to what was then Bill Clinton's health care reform plan, which would have required restaurants to give health insurance to full-time employees. They didn't like that. And then there was a whole debate about the minimum wage, which Clinton raised, and the NRA went along with that, but very importantly, cut a deal in which they were fine with the federal minimum wage going up so long as the minimum wage for tipped workers remained $2.13 an hour and remained frozen in place, where it has been frozen in place ever since. Now, since then, the NRA has just quietly and very effectively, I think, built its influence both in Washington, and it has partners in the 50 states who share a mission and also fight for the interests of restaurant owners. And that makes sense, right? It is the restaurant industry's lobby. So fighting for restaurant owners' interests, you know, there's nothing nefarious about that. What's striking to me and what my article is about is how the NRA is very adept and savvy at presenting its agenda as the best thing for workers, which I do not think is the case.
I see. It kind of positions itself as like a ground-up kind of organization.
Absolutely. And keep in mind, there aren't a lot of unions in restaurants. There aren't sort of countervailing institutions that tell workers, hey, this is what's best for you. Mm. It's a precarious workforce, the restaurant industry, one of the largest employers of youth, of people of color. 60% of the employees are women. It's so overlooked, much less likely than most private sector employees to have health insurance, to have paid sick leave, to have a whole range of employer-provided benefits. It's also disproportionately likely to be poor. Tipped workers and restaurant workers are more than twice as likely as regular workers to earn below the poverty line and to rely on food stamps and other government benefits. So we are not talking about a powerful, wealthy class of people. Their interests are in having more benefits, being able to take a vacation and maybe even get paid while you're on vacation as other workers do, or having more job security, or having less fluctuation in your salary week to week because it all depends on tips.
Yeah. You know, one thing I wanted to understand better is that you describe the NRA as being really powerful. And I think most people think of these big lobbying groups as being powerful because they have a lot of money. But you described it a little bit differently. You said, I mean, it has money behind it, but it's more that it has really strong outreach.
Very strong.
It's a really good political machine. I mean, can you say more about that?
Yeah. I mean, look, as you know, one legislative aide in Washington put it to me, every single elected official in the country has restaurants in their district, right? And some of those restaurants are the places they host fundraisers, they host events, they have relationships with these people. And the NRA is very good at cultivating these relationships, and so are the state affiliates, the partners. The other reason I think it's really good at politics is it presents itself as the champion of mom-and-pop restaurants, you know, the great neighborhood restaurants that everybody loves. And who's against that, right? This is not ExxonMobil. This is not Walmart. But when you look at the NRA, you do find that there are big restaurant chains, you know, that are behind it. There's very big money. And a lot of restaurants don't actually belong to the NRA and don't subscribe to its agenda.
I was hoping I could ask you to give us a few examples from your reporting of the NRA's advocacy in different states and what that has looked like. You give some examples in your piece. One was from Arizona. Can you talk about what happened there in 2024?
Yeah. Well, I opened my piece with a hearing that unfolded in Arizona. Usually it's sparsely attended, and it's mostly the familiar lobbyists. But on this occasion, you had a whole bunch of people come in, and they were wearing identical green t-shirts, and the t-shirts had a slogan on them, and it said, "Save our tips." And I interviewed one of the then representatives in Arizona, Annalise Ortiz, and she assumed they had come because the bill that was being debated would have enabled restaurant owners to pay their tipped workers less. And the folks in the Save Our Tips t-shirts all said they wanted this bill. And she got confused. Like, who are these folks? Well, then she came across a video on YouTube, and it revealed that the people in the Save Our Tips t-shirts were not entry-level servers. They all had ties to the Arizona Restaurant Association. So it looked like this grassroots, you know, tipped workers come to the hearing to testify. What it turned out to be was a kind of AstroTurf campaign where they made it look that way, but it wasn't really that way.
So what ended up happening?
That measure was pushed by the Arizona Restaurant Association to oppose a different measure called the One Fair Wage Bill, which would have eliminated the subminimum wage in Arizona. Well, that One Fair Wage Bill never got on the ballot, but the industry-sponsored measure, which was designed to lower the wages of tipped workers, did get on the ballot. However, Arizona voters rejected it decisively. And I think that is a credit to the fact that people like Annalise Ortiz and a lot of community organizations and others got the message out, hey, this isn't going to help tipped workers, it's going to hurt them. And once voters understood that, they rejected it overwhelmingly.
I understand for this piece, you did end up speaking with Sean Kennedy, the executive vice president of public affairs at the NRA. What did he tell you about the NRA and its work? Did he have comment on anything that you brought up for your piece?
Yes, he's had a lot of comment. And I think, as he, I think, rightly noted, the restaurant industry is very competitive. It operates on small margins. And keeping labor costs lower helps restaurants stay alive and compete. And so from his point of view, it's good for owners, but it's also good for workers, because if you raise the wages too high, and this is what the NRA and its state partners always say when there are proposals to raise wages for tipped workers, you raise those wages too high, prices will go up, customers will stop eating out, or they will stop tipping, and lo and behold, the workers you thought you were helping are actually being hurt. And the NRA is very effective at getting this message out to workers. And many of the workers I spoke to said to me quite openly, you know, I believed it when I was told that. Now, here's a little counter to why that isn't the whole story. There are 7 states in America where there is no difference between the minimum wage and the minimum wage for tipped workers. These states include Alaska, Montana, Washington, California, Minnesota. And guess what? People still eat out in those states, and they still tip. And so that's one sort of live experiment we have to show that actually this could be done differently.
Mm-hmm. Is there any information about that you learned about what it was like to transition to that for any of those states? Did people have to get used to it? Did people going out to restaurants kind of dip for a while?
Yeah, so I asked that exact question to an economist named Sylvia Allegretto, because she has written a detailed paper about those 7 states, kind of comparing them to other states. One of the most striking findings of her paper, by the way, was that the poverty rate among tipped workers in those states is significantly lower than in other states. But I asked her, you know, what is this transition like? And she said, well, you know, in those states, this has been the case for a long time. So we don't have good information about that. But what she did say is that in cities and municipalities and states that have raised the tipped minimum wage, usually that's done phasing it in, sort of transition, right? It's not an overnight, let's go from $2.13 to $15 an hour.
As we've seen with raising the minimum wage too, right? Often
absolutely.
It's kind of a slow ramp up.
Yeah. Exactly. So it is a ramp up. And she also said it makes complete sense that transition is going to be hard and harder for small family-owned restaurants, you know, with really small margins.
Sure.
And in her view, the way we should think about it is let's design policies to help them. How about, you know, tax relief for those restaurants that might really struggle with the transition in the beginning? But what she doesn't think we should do is, because of this, assume the only thing we can continue doing is paying tipped workers so little money. That's a really unfair and regressive way to assume things have to be. And by the way, I did interview some restaurant owners who pay their workers the full minimum wage with tips on top. And it was really interesting to hear them talk, because, you know, what they said was, yes, this does increase my labor costs some. It also reduces turnover. These folks continue to work because they're getting paid a living wage. There used to be an assumption within the economics profession that in low-wage industries like restaurant work and fast food restaurants, if you raise the minimum wage, employment will go down. And today, the majority of economists no longer believe that, because the studies have contradicted it.
What are some of the positions that this group has taken on other issues related to service workers?
That was actually the most surprising thing I discovered in my reporting. The state partners of the National Restaurant Association have been really active in recent years in loosening regulations on child labor. Violations of child labor are extremely common in the restaurant industry. And during the pandemic, there was a labor shortage in the restaurant industry. This is where this all began. And so some of the state restaurant associations started pushing for loosening the restrictions that, you know, for example, teens handling alcohol when they work, or teens working late hours during weekdays on school nights, and also loosening restrictions on the kind of work, including hazardous jobs that minors work. And in some states, these laws were indeed changed. And there's been a lot of investigative reporting and some really damning revelations about the dangers that this has posed to minors.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate what you're saying about, you know, the existence of a National Restaurant Association not being nefarious in and of itself. But it does sound like there have been quite a few disingenuous, at best, if you want to call them, campaigns that they have led to make it seem like they are made up of and definitely working in the best interest of service workers and tipped workers, when that's not the case. So where is the conversation today on raising the subminimum wage? Is that proposal getting any traction?
There are advocates. You can find them in just about any city or state that push for this. There's one particular organization, One Fair Wage, that has been at the forefront of this battle for a long time. But it has been a struggle. And I think that it's fair to say that that struggle has been turned aside and turned back in pretty dramatic ways. I mentioned in the piece that in Massachusetts, a very liberal state, very pro-labor, you know, Elizabeth Warren being one of the senators, well, they voted down by a large margin a proposal to end the subminimum wage for tipped workers. And the Massachusetts Restaurant Association and the message it put out about how bad this would be, not just for restaurants, but for workers, played a big role in that. And I should say, I spoke to some workers there. One of them sent me the bills that he would hand out during this campaign to customers. And on top, it said, "Your crew votes no on question five." Question five was the ballot initiative to increase wages for tipped workers. So here you are, you're eating at your favorite restaurant, you get your bill, you're wondering, oh yeah, I kind of heard about that. Oh, look, my own crew, the people who just served me, are against this, right? Well, what are you going to think? Vote against it too, right? I should say that that worker who sent me this bill voted yes on question five. But the point is that the restaurant association, the industry, and, you know, restaurant managers and owners got that message out. They put up signs in windows and, you know, bars and restaurants. And of course, a lot of customers then got that sign.
It brings it all back to something that you started our conversation with, which is the way in which Donald Trump has managed to have this populist appeal, has managed to connect with working class workers and position himself and his policies as things that will ultimately benefit them, when actually they're not in their best interests.
Absolutely. And I think people shouldn't be fooled. I think that the no tax on tips policy, let's be clear, it was part of a large bill that every study has shown will benefit wealthy people far more than those in the bottom quarter of income earners. I've heard the proposal described over and over again as populist. And, you know, I would put that word in quotes, or I would say, well, this is populism for billionaires. Having said that, I should say that, you know, one of the reasons Trump has been able to take this position and kind of present himself as the champion of tipped workers is that Democrats have been slow to present an alternative agenda that would help these workers. You know, if you don't fight for workers, if you don't give them something that will actually benefit them and don't speak to them, you're not going to win them over.
Well, now that this no taxes on tips policy has been signed into law in its current form, what do you suspect will happen as a result of it? Like, do you think it's going to have much impact?
I think that the benefit for workers is exaggerated, and I don't foresee dramatic changes. I should say there's a Congressman Horford in Nevada who has proposed an alternative approach which would eliminate taxes on tips, but also eliminate the subminimum wage for tipped workers. The economist I spoke to said, if we really want to help tipped workers, we should raise wages, eliminate the subminimum wage, and then think about taxation policy. I'm not an economist and I don't have a crystal ball, but I would not be at all surprised if we read articles in a couple of years about the perverse incentives that eliminating taxes on tips created.
What is the thing that you like to tell people after having done all this reporting and thinking in this way to consider, to maybe challenge the way that they are thinking about tipping and service workers?
One of the most striking things about this whole debate is that it is a very American debate. You go to Europe, and one of the reasons that they don't have a tipping culture is because the people are paid a living wage with benefits. And that is the case in most of the developed world. The United States, it's different. If you don't tip, that worker really will not be able to make the minimum wage. We have a tipping culture, and tipping is bleeding into so many different aspects of, you know, the economy and our daily sort of lives. I think that it's important for customers to tip well because you are helping them, but come away with the realization that the person you're really helping is the owner. And if that bothers you, as I think it should, then we need to have a conversation about why these workers in so many states are still getting $2.13 an hour for their base salary.
Al, thank you for this reporting. This was really fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me on. Great to have this conversation.
You can read AL Press's story for The New Yorker, No Tax on Tips is an Industry Plant, on Apple News. We'll link to it on our show notes page. And if you're listening in the news app, we've queued up the article to play for you next.